The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I have one, but I was just noticing people are putting on sweaters and shawls, and so it's not just one person. Extra sweaters. I want my talk to warm your heart, not freeze you off. And I'm going to get some help from the AC. So, delighted to be here tonight. It's always nice to be here. And who's new here for the first time tonight? One person, two people, three people, four people. Keep your hands up for a moment. Yeah, I want people to see the new people. Okay, great. Fantastic. Oh, five people. Welcome. Fantastic. So, actually, since we have a lot of new people, let's take a moment just to say hello. So, just at least say hello to two people around you and introduce yourself. Just say your name, who you are. This is a community. So, let's start by making it a community. Go. Especially welcome the new people, the old timers. So if the old timers would especially talk to the new people so that they feel welcome, those people. Great. Excellent. Your first time too?
First time person.
New enough. Great. So welcome everyone, whether it's your first time on Thursdays, first time at all at IMC, you're an old-timer or any of the above. So I too was a newbie 10 years ago at IMC myself. A friend of mine brought me here, I remember. The first place that I learned how to meditate. And at first, actually, I was mostly interested in just learning how to meditate. And I had a chronic health condition, and I had heard that meditation has had healing power. So this friend of mine who had done some silent retreats and was part of the IMC community brought me a couple of nights, and I sat and I meditated and sat through the Dharma talks. And at first, listening to Dharma talks just to me seemed part of the package. It was just something that I sat through, but really I was here to come and learn how to meditate. That's where it was. It was that for me. So, and then in the next phase of my practice, as I was doing silent retreats and practicing more and more, my practice was also focused on experiential practicing, experiencing and seeing for myself. And again, I was now more interested in listening to Dharma talks than I was before. I wasn't quite tuning them out. But still, experientially, that's where my focus was. And as long as the talks really pointed to the practice, then that was great for me with the pointers. Okay, what do I see? What do I see next? What do I do? In the next phase of my practice, the talks, listening and reading and study really became an integral part of my practice, because I realized, first of all, experientially, actually after having experienced and seen, all the readings and all the talks now made sense to me. Like, right, that's what they mean. This is what it's like. And then further, the talks then fed back into my practice, because they became more of a pointer to point me more into my experience. So I know that for different people, practice happens differently. I have a friend who's also an academic, and his entry into the Dharma really was from reading and contemplating, reading the sutras and doing a lot of study. Whereas for me, even though I'm an academic, it was more experiential. So whatever your way is, whatever works is great, is fantastic. But just to share that I've now learned that the framework is something that, I mean, the framework, the Buddhist framework is something that has me for, that for me has really arisen from the experience, not from thinking about it. Oh, I need to believe this. Oh, I need to subscribe to this. It was really experiential, just sitting on the cushion, observing my experience in daily life, saying, ah, this makes sense, of course, this is the way things are. And then, oh yeah, these are the teachings. So, and that's the way the teachings really, really are. They're not a set of precepts to believe in or set of beliefs. They arise from experience. So, there's a beautiful story in Gil Fronsdale's book, A Monastery Within, that I would like to read, which speaks to this beautifully. And that is called Alternative to Philosophy. After lunch one day, the abbess and a visiting philosophy professor went for a walk along the river that passed by the monastery. Being a hot day, like today, they eventually sat down to cool off under the shade of a large tree. They didn't have AC, so they sat down under a large tree. The professor asked, "I'm interested in learning Buddhist philosophy. Could you tell me some of the fundamental doctrines of your religion?" "Well," said the abbess, "I don't think I can help you much. You see, we don't rely on any philosophy at the monastery." "But," continued the professor, "everyone, consciously or unconsciously, has a philosophy with which they make sense of their life and their purpose." "It is different in the monastery," replied the abbess. "At the monastery, we rely on awareness, not doctrines." "But," insisted the professor, "you must have a philosophy which explains the importance of being aware." After pausing to consider how best to respond, the abbess said, "As we walked along, we were both aware of how hot, sweaty, and tired we had become from our walk. We did not need a philosophy to tell us the benefits of sitting down here in the shade. If you put your hand on a hot stove, you don't need a philosophy to pull the hand away. If a baby is crying from hunger, the need to feed the child is obvious to the parent. Buddhist practice does not depend on having a set of doctrines or beliefs. Rather, it depends on being aware of what brings release from suffering. Rather than being taught Buddhist philosophy at the monastery, the monks and nuns are trained to develop an acutely refined awareness. With such sensitivity, ultimate liberation is as natural as sitting down in the shade on a hot day." Let me repeat that last line. "With such sensitivity, ultimate liberation is as natural as sitting down in the shade on a hot day." So this sense of awareness, this sensitivity, when it is keenly applied to observing experiential phenomena, can really provide a pointer to seeing our thoughts, our attitudes, and our perspectives, and to see which ones are conducive to freedom and which ones are not. Just as simple as that. So, such an awareness, such a sensitivity, can give rise to a helpful perspective, because then you can see what's a helpful perspective to have, what's not a helpful perspective to have. And in the teachings, that is called right view. And tonight's talk is about right view, which is the first step of the Eightfold Noble Path. When I heard the terminology right view years ago, I had a reaction that was not exactly positive. Both a reaction to the word right and to the word view. So right to me seemed right and wrong. You should have this view. This is the belief you subscribe to. This is the right view. This is the right view. This is what you need to believe in order to be a card-carrying Buddhist. Otherwise, go get out. And I saw the word view as a doctrine. This is the right view. This is our doctrine. This is us. This is our right view. That's the wrong view. It's us against them. Well, it's a translation. You know, at the time, there many of the translations were done from Pali. Things were, you know, a little clunky. But what I really like, I think what it really means, what the sense is arising from practice, is not right view. I much prefer wise or helpful perspective. It's a perspective that's helpful to your own freedom, to what makes you happy, to what helps you not suffer. You don't have to believe it. It's not right. It's just helpful. So it's just a way of seeing life that's more conducive to freedom, ease, happiness, and not suffering so much. So I'll continue to use right view in the talk, just so that we know what we're talking about and how it fits within Buddhism. But every time I say that, and I'll also exchange it with a wise perspective or helpful perspective, because it's really, that's what it is. So I'm going to take a pause for a moment, and since we also have lots of new people, any questions so far? Any comments so far? We'll make this interactive. There's lots of lists. That's all. Okay. Yeah, there are lots of lists. So we don't really need to think about the lists right now. So let's just think about it in terms of wise perspective. How's that? Okay. That's all we need. So if you need that list, we'll come back to them. How's that? So, did I see a hand somewhere? Oh, you can't hear me. Okay. Is it okay now, or? Yeah. Sort of? Yes, I think that was Nikki, you're not loud enough sign, right? Yes, okay. Is this okay now? Sort of? Okay, I'll try to speak a little louder. Maureen, you might have to help me push it up. Okay, all right. So helpful perspective or right view is a thread that really weaves through all of the teachings. It is the first step of the Eightfold Path, and it's also its culmination. So in the sense of it being the forerunner of the entire path, it's that it really enables us to have a destination. I mean, without having a helpful perspective to at least know how to point our mind, it's like trying to get somewhere without a map, right? You get into the car, you have gas, you have energy, you want to drive, but you don't know where you're going and where you're aiming, and you just keep driving and you end somewhere and it may not be maybe anywhere. But so the right view gives us a direction as to where to point our mind in the practice. So it's well known in studies in psychology that our beliefs and perspectives govern both our attitudes, our actions, and our whole orientation to existence. There are well-known studies about how our perception, how our beliefs actually change our perception even. A friend of mine was just telling me actually tonight about the study that just came out where if they put people in different rooms, one set of subjects are getting electric shocks. They're not the lucky ones. Another group are in another room supposedly giving electric shocks. So the people in the room who are getting electric shocks, if they are told that the people in the other room are intentionally trying to hurt them, then they experience more pain. If they are told that the pain is random, is set by a computer or something, then they experience less pain, even though the stimulus is the same. So our attitude really determines our perception. There was another study that I just read. This is an interesting one. Also talks about potentially releasing potentials that for perception we don't know about. People were given a set of questions or quizzes, and they were told that their answers are going to be flashed on a screen so quick that they couldn't read them, but unconsciously they could pick up the answers to the quizzes that they were given. So that was subject pool A. And subject pool B were said, oh, these are just random, you know, you're not getting it, you know, they're random things that are being flashed. Well, in both cases, there were random things that were being flashed on the screen. But the group that thought they were being given the answers scored more highly on the quiz. Now, how's that for your perspective? How it actually changes how you behave and your perception in the world. And also, experientially, let's think about our own lives. Haven't you noticed when, I don't know, say, when if you think that somebody, say, is happy to see you or likes you, then the way you greet them is different. Your perception, the way you are in the world, the way you are with that person, your behavior becomes completely different. But if you have had a miscommunication with someone, or you think you've had a miscommunication with someone, and you see them, you sort of cower, and your behavior all changes. Is your perspective? Your perspective also changes the way you perceive their actions towards you, right? How many people have had experiences like this? Yeah, of course, everyone, please, thank you. So we just know that our perspective really affects the way we think, the way we behave, our perception, and this idea of right view is the same thing, is really a perspective that is helpful, that changes our perception of the world and the way we act. So our views may be clearly formulated, or they might be hazy conceptual, hazy concepts, which we haven't really formulated, but they still affect our perceptions of the world and our actions. And our actions then predicate the effects, the consequences in the world. So basically, our beliefs, our perspective, even if they're not well-formed and we don't quite have access to them, they still condition our perceptions and our actions and the consequences in the world. So all of this is to say that our perspective, our view, the way we expect the world to run is really important. It determines our whole life. It's not just the conceptual thing of this is how I think about the world. Mahatma Gandhi puts this very nicely. He says, your beliefs become your thoughts. Your thoughts become your words. Your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your values. And your values become your destiny. It all starts with your beliefs. So to understand the right view, we need to understand the whole of the Pali Canon, in a way, because the right view teachings really weave through everything, all the teachings. And again, it's not an understanding that arises from a doctrinal belief. It's really something that arises from paying attention to the experience, to natural phenomena as experienced by us experientially. Speaking of the threat that goes through everything, there is a poem from William Stafford called "The Way It Is," and you can think of it both as your practice. It talks about the threat, and also think about it as the right view. It goes, "There is a thread you follow. It goes among things that change. But it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. But it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread." So having talked about this thread, this right view, so getting a sense of what is it? What is this helpful perspective that helps us see things as they are? There are two types of right view. One is called the mundane right view, which relates to the confines of of this world in terms of action, consequences of our actions. And then there is second right view, which is called the supramundane or superior right view, which both leads to liberation and arises from penetrating Nibbana. So the first one is concerned with the laws that govern the material and spiritual progress and the states of existence and, for example, the consequences of action both within micro moments of this life as well as rebirth into future lives in higher or lower planes. So let's talk about that one first. So understanding that one, the mundane right view, is really intertwined with understanding karma, wholesomeness and unwholesome, as well as cause and effect. And at any point you have questions, just raise your hand. I'm going to get a little technical for a little bit to sort of explain what this is, but we'll get practical again in a moment. So at first, getting a correct grasp of the law of karma, the literal name of this right view, the mundane right view, is right view of the ownership of action, which is kama sakata samaditi. Samaditi, right view, kama sakata, the ownership of action, kama sakata, ownership of action, which goes like this. Beings are the owners of their action, the heirs of their action. They spring from their actions, are bound to their actions, and are supported by their actions. Whatever deeds they do, good or bad, of those they shall be heirs. So let's contemplate that. Let's think about that for a moment. So what does that say to us? What does that mean in terms of having a right perspective? In terms of being the owner of our own actions. Yes, excellent.
Is it kind of like you don't have control necessarily about what happens to you, but you have control of how you react to it? Can I make an additional comment? About that pain study that you said, where the people felt more pain or less pain if someone else was causing them pain, I have been thinking about the element of forgiveness. So if there was a third group who said that it was a forgiveness study and the other people were to cause them pain, but they were to focus on forgiving them for that pain, would that be an example of the ownership of what you were saying with ownership of your actions is the element of forgiveness, because you can't control the pain that is happening to you?
Mm-hmm. So thanks for the comment. I think a couple of things come up as you say this. So regarding I go to the experiment first. So the experiment, in a way, pointing out to how our perspective changes our feelings and physiological perceptions, really perception in the world. And it sounds like what you were suggesting would be a nice third way of, way of testing a hypothesis of seeing how that actually changes the perception of a third subject pool, if they were given that as a perspective to see how that would change their pain threshold and their pain behavior as relating to that specific experiment. And in terms of karma being owners of the actions and heirs of the actions, bound by the actions, supported by the actions, it's a way of negating the ideas of, say, nihilism, that whatever you do is just going to go away and you know, there is no consequences, or also determinism, that everything is determined, you have no choice, and it just happens to you, and that's about it. So it's basically, it's a middle path between these alternatives, that there is, it allows some room for choice, for making choices of your actions within the constraints, within many, many constraints that we have, both genetically and socially and a lot of other. I don't want to get into a discussion of free will, maybe some other time, but it allows really for that, really, really allows for being an owner of one's choices, of one's actions and one's karma, and realizing that one does have a choice and one is an heir to the choices that one makes. So that also, that brings both a sense of responsibility as well as freedom, because you're not stuck, right? You're not stuck in determinism. You can change. You can have choice. You can become aware of that moment of choice when awareness is strong and something comes up, for example, annoyance, a disturbance, and you can choose whether to act with hostility towards someone or with kindness. Is that moment of choice? Is that moment of freedom? So understanding the love of karma by understanding that you have ownership of your actions and the results and the consequences of your actions. Does that help? Yeah. Thank you. So tied into that is continuing with understanding the karma. Here's a quote. Monks, it is volition that I call action. Kama is the same word for action. Having willed, one performs an action through body, speech, and mind. So here, it's actually interesting. What I want to highlight is that karma here is being equated with volition, making karma a mental event. So an action is not just an action of the body, an action, but also an action of speech, as well as an action of the mind. So through any of these doors of body, speech, or mind, volition can be expressed. through creating karma, through an action, action of the mind, action of speech, action of the body. So let's hold this understanding of karma here for a moment. And then together with that, then there's an understanding of wholesome and unwholesome actions. Unwholesome akusala and wholesome kusala. So here the definition is actually pretty straightforward. Wholesome action is one that leads to benefits, both for yourself and others, and unwholesome actions, unwholesome kamma would be one that causes suffering for yourself and for others. So tying this with right view or helpful perspective, basically understanding that there is cause and effect, and we are all heirs, we're all owners of our own actions. And both wholesome and unwholesome actions cause different fruits. They have different fruits. So if an action is supported, it comes from the three wholesome roots, or actually let's talk about the opposite. If they come from the three unwholesome roots of greed, aversion, and delusion, They give rise to unwholesome fruit of action. And if they arise from non-greed, non-aversion, and non-delusion, then they give rise to wholesome fruit. So, and also here, just as a side note, non-greed isn't just not having greed, but it implies renunciation, detachment, and generosity. And non-aversion isn't just non-aversion, it also implies loving-kindness, sympathy, and gentleness, and non-delusion implies wisdom. So basically, in a way, seeing the right view, helpful perspective, is one that allows you to actually be cognizant of the fruits of your actions, and become sensitive to what gives rise to whether an action is arising from greed, hatred, and delusion, or from the opposites of them, from places of kindness and wisdom, and lost track of my thought, and generosity, for example. So in a way, what I've presented, and I know for a moment I've gotten a little too theoretical, in a way, this is understanding the right view in a long perspective of one's life, that actions lead to consequences, being aware of how one lives one life. But now let's bring it to moment-to-moment experience, micro-moments of experience. So suppose you're sitting on the cushion and a pain comes up. If we don't see that with a helpful perspective, okay, this is pain arising, I don't like it, I have aversion to it, then the mind can get reactive. So if we personalize it, you know, there's pain, I hate it, I don't like it, I don't want to be here, this is terrible, why am I here, I should be doing somewhere else, you know, mind going off, blah, 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 and getting reactive and getting upset and maybe getting reactive also with other people. Whereas with having the right perspective, actually seeing things as they are, seeing that this is a thought that arises, or this is a thought that has arisen from the sensation of pain. And pain is impersonal. And there is a moment of choice in how to deal with the sensations that have arisen. So basically, seeing things as they are from an experiential way, not making them personal. So there's a truth of anatta or impersonal nature of experience that can be brought into into this right perspective, into helpful perspective. In fact, the three characteristics of non-self and impermanence and dukkha, suffering, seeing experience within those lights, and not taking things personally, or not seeing and not having attachment to experience as desirable and with tanha and attachment, is one way to understand helpful perspective or right view. Does that make sense? Questions? I feel I've gone into a little bit of a loop here. So, is that crystal clear? Does it make sense? Yeah, question.
It's not really a question, but I'm trying to absorb what you're talking about. I think you tie things very well together. When you first mentioned about the right view, I immediately thought about wise choices, because we're giving that we have free choice. And when we take the situation, like you said, it has a cause-effect relationship. If we choose the right choice, and that will avoid the suffering, then I think that's probably the thing we're after when we meditate. I like you go about it and to try to tie all this together as far as what is the word you said, cause-effect?
Karma?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, actually, I'm going to now open it to more comments, because the question that I have for you is, we have talked a little bit about right view or helpful perspective in terms of the mundane right view and how it's seen in terms of tying together karma, conditionality, wholesome and unwholesome actions. But really, how does helpful perspective come about in your own life? How does right view come about in your own life and in your own practice? Where have you noticed it come up in your practice, either on the cushion or in your daily life?
I have one of my daughters is.
You have to hold it much closer.
One of my daughters has a neurological issue, which makes her have hypersensitivity to sounds and touch and everything. And we didn't know about it until recently, but she's very, explosive. She's completely lose it. And I started coming to meditation to try to calm myself in terms of how I react to her when she's escalating. And it's really been amazing to watch when I'm able to not go into, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening, I'm so tired. If I can just sort of stop and say, oh, she's really upset, and just calm myself, I can, sometimes she just continues to unravel, but sometimes she'll still look at me like, oh, you're calm. And then she'll be able to look together. And so I think it's really helped my whole family.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, I think that's a great example. Now that you know what is happening and your perspective has changed, just completely changes the perception and everything. Yeah. A very helpful perspective. Thank you.
I have a really mundane one. I've had too much coffee today, and my head keeps on running away with things. And I remind myself, you've had too much coffee. And it's like, oh, okay. It's like this, you know, it's my wheel keeps on going and exaggerating everything, and all it is caffeine.
Not a helpful perspective.
Perspective after the point.
Thanks, Marie.
For me, the concept of right view or skillful perspective is almost too big to grasp at one time. I mean, Mary talked about lists, and I know that some of these lists have words like intention and confidence or similar things, and it seems to cover all of that. So it's sort of, I just find it hard to hold on to the whole thing at once.
I'm glad you brought that up, Jim, because as I was saying earlier, in a way, everything that we study, all of those lists, they have, in all the teachings, in the Four Noble Truths, in the Three Characteristics, and everywhere you look, the right view is part of it, is a thread that goes through everything. So in order to really understand right view, you have to understand everything. As I try in my own practice to see, okay, what is the helpful perspective? What is the helpful perspective in any given time? Sometimes it comes to be simply to be this, which is having clear awareness, just to see phenomena as it is. Sometimes with the three characteristics, seeing their impersonal nature and their impermanence and their unsatisfactoriness, bringing that in. And basically also seeing the consequence, seeing the link between what arises one moment and arises the next. And that's the conditionality. That's the karma. So in a way, for me, that's the whole thing. Like all of the teachings, so the three characteristics, the way in which I try to see a phenomena, I try to infuse those three characteristics in the way, like, is this permanent? No. Is this really personal? No, it's not personal. Is it really satisfactory, permanent satisfaction? Actually, no. So that brings the three characteristics. And then seeing, oh, this action, for example, oh, seeing the water fountain, ooh, I'm thirsty. That gives rise to the next. And that is the conditionality. And that is the, that's, in a way, it's the law of karma. This leads to that. It's the action and consequence, which is another way to understand right view, is that conditionality and being heirs to our own karma. So seeing the conditionality of how the mind goes from that, and then, and also, of course, with volition, putting volition in there, because that, oh, and then deciding, for example, being thirsty and deciding to go and drink water, this is not necessarily wholesome or unwholesome, but seeing that volitionality in my action. So in a way, right view is all there, can be simplified in a moment. Instead of seeing a multi-life view or the whole Pali canon, I sort of simplify it for myself in this way. I hope that's helpful. Yeah.
But after your talk, I am thinking about that, you know, that, and I am not seeing that relationship as a map. I am seeing, you know, after your talk, that probably is a way of walking or a way of seeing within that, you know, that instrument. It's more like not really something to. I thought that at the very beginning when you mentioned that, you know, metaphor, that it was like more like a much more, I don't know, abstract way of inclining the mind. Mm-hmm. But as you know, after your talk, it seems to me that it's more like that we are in the terrain and we are making the decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It confused me a little bit at the very beginning. Yeah. So it not seem really like a map, but more like an, like probably like a, well, I'm forgetting the word, but it's like more like a.
Like a compass, maybe?
Yeah. No,
yes, I agree. And I really appreciate you bringing that up, because as I think about it, you're right on. Because a map, in a way, I mean, I brought that up because it gives, I mean, you want to have a sense of where you're going, right? Where you want to turn yourself, right? And the compass is a much better metaphor, I think, than a map, because a map is, I want to go there, and that's where I'm going, and, you know, direct. And it's not, it's more like, oh, this is what will be helpful. You know, I might be turned around, but, oh, this is the direction that I need to be turning. Yeah. Nice one. Thank you for observing that. Cool. Any other observations I can use in my next talk?
Yeah. The idea of a compass is also going through my head, because also a map implies I know where I'm going, I know how to get there, yeah. And if I don't go this way, it's not the right way.
Yeah. Right.
So not only do you have to go this way, yeah. But you also end up here. Whereas if you have a compass that's, you know, sort of mixing metaphors, tuned correctly,
yeah.
You can end up somewhere totally different. But at each, it sounds like at each choice, you're looking at this compass. Is it, which way should I go? This way. And if you keep following the positive or helpful choice, or however you want to call it, you end up somewhere totally different. And so you have to have confidence that those choices are going to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where I have some difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Is this, you know, but having the confidence that, all right, if this choice isn't helpful, well, the next one might be. And eventually, you know, 8 out of 10 times I'll get to the right place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A quick comment about the confidence also. No, trusting that this is a true and tried path, right? And it will work. If you have the diligence, if you have the passion, the desire, and all the necessary and the wisdom and mindfulness, you know, it'll all come together. And also something that builds confidence is the company of people who are further along the path, and you see, wow, they do have more peace. They do seem to be freer. And that gives me confidence.
Sort of a metaphor that just sort of popped in my mind as we're talking about this, the idea of seeing things as they really are. I had the vision of a mouse going through a maze in the dark, and it's using its whiskers, and it has to just deal with the reality that it meets as it goes through the maze. It can't say, oh, well, I'm going to, you know, take a left and then a right and then a left. You know, it mm-hmm. just has to go where the whiskers mm-hmm. tell it to go.
Right, yeah. Thank you. So we have a couple of minutes left, and I want to invite you to close your eyes for a moment and reflect on what you have heard tonight, both from me and from others. And what might have also come up in your own mind as a helpful reflection? And see what comes up. If nothing comes up, that's fine too. But if something comes up, something that you can take forward with yourself and perhaps share with someone on the phone, maybe tomorrow. And now open your eyes and I invite you to share if you wish. We have another minute left, so if somebody would like to share what came up for them. Someone who hasn't spoken yet, that'd be great. Thank you.
In relation to the words that we've been talking about with right view, such as wise, helpful, map, and compass, I continually come back to what would be something that gives us helpful guidance in along the words of wisdom, and I guess the word I'm looking for would be age. I feel like that map and that guidance and that helpfulness comes with time. So age and time are what I feel like popped into my head there.
Thank you. Anyone else?
I think that also whether or not you can perceive age, or you know, I think that it's also just a matter of moment to moment and just what your attitude is, you know, in that current moment. And I think what I kept thinking about is just your attitude in that moment, you know, and that in itself could be the right perception. And it you know, you should remain positive or try to at least as much as you can. I think that's, if you don't want to think about impermanence, you just remain positive, you know. I think, if anything, that might be the right perspective.
And on the note of moment-to-moment attitude, our time is up and we close on that positive note. So thank you so much for coming tonight, for your practice and your attention. I hope this has been helpful.